We're looking at some of the things that happened in Jesus' third year of public ministry. We started with the feeding of the 5,000 shortly before Passover of 32, and how Jesus, because of the excitement of the crowd, departed the region of the Promised Land and went over to Tyre and Sidon to try to seek some solitude there for a while with his apostles. But eventually, probably after Passover, so probably sometime during the summer of that same year, he returns to the area of the Sea of Galilee and then goes down on the eastern side of the sea into the northern portion of the Decapolis, probably near the city of Hippos, which is in that southeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. And there in a remote area, he begins to minister to a large crowd of people. And having done that for a while, Jesus then decides it is time to send this crowd home. So let's read again from Mark chapter number 8, starting at verse number 1. And remember that we've got a parallel in Matthew chapter number 15 that we can draw from as well. So probably summer, I would guess in the latter part of the summer. In those days, when again a great crowd had gathered, and they had nothing to eat. And the reason they don't have anything to eat is because they've eaten up whatever supplies they brought with them to this rural area. And now it's been 3 days. We'll find that out in just a moment. He called his disciples to him and said to them, "I have compassion on the crowd." Remember the word compassion has that sense of the butterflies in the stomach feeling where you're feeling sorry. You're feeling that you'd like to help out some people. "So I have compassion on the crowd because they've been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on their way. And some of them have come from far away." Some of them may be from other parts of Galilee, past the Sea of Galilee. Remember, Jesus had come from Tyre and Sidon, following the Roman road system, no doubt, which would have taken him across the north shore, and he probably picked up a whole bunch of followers at that time, since he was very well known in that area. And these folks have been camping out with him and used up all their supplies. So some of them may have a day or so that they'd have to go back home. And so Jesus is talking to his disciples about this. In the Matthew account, it says, "I'm unwilling to send them away hungry." So he's already hinting at this idea that he wants to take care of their needs before sending them off. Now, in the Mark account, Mark 8:4, his disciples answered him, "How can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place?" In the Matthew account, it's, "Where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd?" Now, if it's taking place where I think it is, they are only about half an hour walk from the city of Hippos. But the city of Hippos is primarily a Gentile city. And so Jewish people, particularly religious Jewish people, would not really feel comfortable buying supplies in a Gentile city because they wouldn't be kosher. So it's a ways to the next kosher shopping area, if you will. These guys are like, "Well, how are we supposed to fix the problem?" Now, those of us that have been studying together have to wonder, why don't they remember the feeding of the 5,000 plus. I mean, they would have had to come right past the area where that happened on the northeast coast of the Sea of Galilee whenever they got here to this remote location. Certainly, it must have occurred to them that, hey, that's the place where Jesus miraculously fed that great big crowd of people several months ago. But it apparently isn't coming to the forefront of their minds, according to the scripture here. Or at least, they don't feel that they can suggest it to Jesus that that's how he should fix the problem. Well, Jesus says to them, in verse number 5 of the Mark account, well, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. And we also know that they had a few small fish. So the last time, it was 5 barley loaves and a couple of fish, right? Here, it's apparently 7 loaves of some type of bread. Might actually be wheat this time, since it's later in the year. And so the wheat harvest is well in. And they've got some more dried fish, a common sort of lunch for people to carry around for themselves. And so that's about all that's left supply-wise. And so Jesus did now exactly what he did several months earlier. Verse 6, he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, so he does the blessing ceremony. Perhaps he lifts the bread up above his head. That was apparently a common practice in thanking God for bread. And then he begins, after he gave thanks, he broke them. And he gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they set them before the crowd. So let's talk about the logistics again, just like we did last time. Jesus takes on the role of the chef. And he is in the metaphorical kitchen, and he's just ripping this bread, ripping it and ripping it and ripping it. And he's taking the fish and doing the same thing, ripping it and ripping it and ripping it. And it's duplicating itself as he does this. And he's filling up containers, filling up baskets of these 12 apostles. There might be some additional disciples that are following him that are also helping in this. And he's giving this to them, and they're rushing off to the different groups of people, because Jesus more than likely did the same thing this time as he did last time, had them sit down in groups of 50 or groups of 100. And they're the disciples, the apostles, are playing the role of wait staff. And so they're running to group after group after group. Now, for the size that we're talking about here, and Matthew jumps in at this point and tells us, those who ate were 4,000 men besides women and children. So if we use the same sort of mathematical assumptions that we did last time, it's 4,000 plus men. If we've got as many as women plus children, we've got probably 12,000 plus individuals. Now think how long it would take for even a large wait staff in a large restaurant to feed 12,000 people. So we're talking about a process here that took a couple of hours or more. And so, verse number 8 in our Mark account, it says that they ate and were satisfied. And so they didn't just get like a little tiny symbolic morsel of food. It wasn't some of that haute cuisine where there's a tiny bit of thing in a decorative fashion on a plate where you go away hungry. These guys ate a decent meal. They felt like, now I can rest tonight, or I can make the walk to the next place where I'm going to rest. So they ate and they were satisfied, and then Mark tells us, and remember, Mark seems to be passing on to us the preaching of Simon Peter, who was a witness there. They took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. Now, just like last time, we end up with more leftovers than we had starting material. There wasn't enough, just 7 loaves and a couple of fish, there wasn't enough to fill 1 basket when we started. But there's 7 baskets of leftover pieces when everything is finished. Verse number 9 is Mark's account of the number. There were about 4,000 people. Now, we know from the Matthew account that that's 4,000 men specifically, plus women and children. So 4,000 at least men, perhaps 12,000 or more people altogether. And then he sent them away. He told them, all right, everybody's had food, head home, because I'm not sticking around here. I'm leaving. Now, I'm throwing that in because that's exactly what he does next. Verse number 10, immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha, or as Matthew tells us, the region of Magadan. So this again helps us identify where he's at. He is near the Sea of Galilee. He is on the eastern side. He is in the region of Decapolis. And so he must be somewhere near the city of Hippos. And so that's the Roman road goes along the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. And so he was up on the hillside here, probably on the eastern side of the Roman road. Once he is finished with the people and tells them they ought to all go home, he walks down across the Roman road and finds a boat that's there on the shore and says, I want to go to the other side with my followers. Let's go. And he gets into the boat and heads west. Now, Magadan, Magdala, as it is also called, is a fairly significant town, from what we understand, on the west shore of the Sea of Galilee, just a couple of miles north of the city of Tiberias. Tiberias was a newer city in the time period we're looking at right here. It was less than a dozen years old. But Magadan, or Magdala, was named Magdala because it sits under the tower of a mountain on that western side of the Sea of Galilee. And it was the Tower of the Fish was pretty much the reason for the name here. Magdala was a major fishing port and fish processing city. And having been there a couple of times now, down in the dock area, you can see all the places where they engaged in this fish processing business. And it seems to be mentioned in some of the first century writings that the fish of Magadan were a preferred fish product elsewhere in the Roman Empire. So that's where Jesus is going. He's not going to some podunk place. He's going to a major city on the other side of the lake. And of course, where there's a major Jewish city, there's going to be the presence of religious leaders. Now, one of the fun things about going to Israel is going to the ruins of one of the synagogues that were in the city of Magdala. Actually, a synagogue that is in the dock or the harbor area of Magdala. And so it may be in this very synagogue that this next confrontation takes place. Mark chapter number 8, verse 11. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him. Now, the Matthew account, which is paralleled in Matthew 16:1, tells us it wasn't just the Pharisees. It says the Pharisees and Sadducees came to test him, and they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. Now, the Pharisees want to promote this idea of a sign because they are religious themselves. They believe in the supernatural, but they don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah that they're looking for. And so they are pushing him to produce a sign that they would be convinced by, some sort of miracle on demand so that they could believe in him. It seems as if once before they'd said something along the lines of, give us bread from heaven on a regular basis, that sort of sign. And Jesus was not going to go along with that. But why are the Sadducees demanding a sign? Because Sadducees are not religious. They don't believe in the supernatural. They don't believe in life after death. They don't believe in a bodily resurrection. They are, for all intents and purposes, secular Jews who utilize the writings of Moses as kind of the maintenance of good society. You know, how do people live together in groups and behave themselves? Well, by following the Mosaic Code. So that's the way the Sadducees use Scripture. So they're demanding of Jesus, give us a sign, show us something supernatural, is probably their way of being able to reject him as well. Because no matter what he does, they will simply say, oh, that's a trick. You're just doing sleight of hand. So Jesus is dealing with two groups that neither one want to believe in him. And that is frustrating. And that shows up in what he says next. So let's look at the Mark account here. Mark 8:12. He sighed deeply in his spirit, which has a connection to some language from the Old Testament. The Old Testament Hebrew uses a word from time to time that we translate into our English Bibles very often as, it repented God to do this, or it made God sorry that he did this. But the word itself in Hebrew is it's a word that's supposed to sound like a deep, exasperated sigh. And it's to show this idea of, oh my goodness, I cannot believe I'm having to do this again. And so Jesus has that sort of sigh here. That sort of, I can't believe that you're still refusing to accept the evidence that's in front of your eyes already. And then he says, why does this generation seek a sign? And I'd say it's actually another sign or a different sign, something supernatural other than what he's already done. Because you know Jesus has been doing miracles right and left, including raising people from the dead and making lame people walk and blind people see and deaf people hear and mute people talk. He's been doing all of that. Why is it that you need more than that? Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. Now, in the Matthew account, we've got a little bit more verbiage, and I want to read that now. Matthew 16:2. He answered them, when it is evening, you say, it's going to be fair weather for the sky is red. And in the morning, it's going to be stormy today for the sky is red and threatening. Now, this represents something equivalent to what I grew up with as a kid. And I grew up in landlocked southern Missouri. And so this must have been imported from somewhere outside of my home area. Because the little saying that we had was, red sky in the morning, sailor takes warning. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. And so it's just kind of this folksy sort of thing that by looking at the atmospheric conditions, you get some sense of what the weather is going to be that day. And so the Jewish people of this time period had something very similar, including the actual idea of a red sky in the morning. It's going to be a rough day, right? Now, the next thing that Jesus says is this. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky. So you've got your own little way of figuring out how the weather is going to go out by looking at the sky, but you can't interpret the sign of the times. But you can't figure out that what I'm doing as Messiah shows to you that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. You can't figure that out on your own. So this is a critique of their demanding of a sign, further signs than what he's already giving. Verse 4, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. And we've seen this language before. And it's the idea that as Jonah spent 3 days and nights in the heart or the belly of the sea monster, the sea creature, the Son of Man will spend 3 days and three nights in the belly of the earth, or the heart of the earth. And we talked about this in relationship to Jesus' ministry on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee already, and how this is a reference to his death and resurrection, that the greatest sign to prove Jesus' identity is his atoning death and his bodily resurrection. And that's why we should always get people to focus on that aspect of Jesus' ministry. All the other teachings and the miracles and things like that, those are great to talk about, and they do lend support to his identity as the Messiah. But the cinching, the cinch pin, the thing that puts us over the top in teaching, is Jesus dying for sin and rising again for justification. And so if the Pharisees and Sadducees won't accept that, they won't accept anything. And then we're told that he left them and departed. The Mark passage says that he got into the boat again and went to the other side. So now, we don't know how long he was at Magdala. Might have been overnight, might have been a few days, but he basically gets back into the boat at some point and heads toward the eastern shore again. And we can be very precise where he was heading. He was heading toward the northeastern shore because he is going to end up near the city of Bethsaida, Julius. But on the boat ride, something else occurs. Verse number 14 of Mark chapter 8. Now, they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. So the disciples, when they jumped in the boat with Jesus, had not brought as many provisions with them as they probably needed. They might have been able to correct that later, but Jesus says something that makes them feel that he's getting after them about not being prepared. Verse 15, he cautioned them, saying, "Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." Matthew account, it's beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And the Pharisees and Sadducees, we were already talking about them. The Pharisees are the religious Jewish leadership. The Sadducees are the secular Jewish leadership. Both groups are rejecting Jesus at this point. The Herod thing might be a little bit confusing. Herodians were those that upheld the right of a member of the Herodian family to hold the leadership position in Judea. At this time, it's actually in the hands of a Roman designee. That would be Pontius Pilate. But the Herodians wanted one of the family of Herod the Great to actually be on that throne. We're working toward that. Apparently, they tended to have that attitude amongst the Sadducees, because that's the parallel between the two groups. So verse number 16 says, they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. So when Jesus said these words about leaven, they immediately went to, oh no, we forgot to bring bread. He's getting after us about that. Verse 17, Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Now, this is a time where Jesus seems genuinely frustrated with his disciples not clicking. I mean, he's only got about 7 months left before the crucifixion, 6 or 7 months left before the crucifixion, and then he'll be heading in his ascension back to heaven, and these guys are going to be in charge of the evangelism of the world. And so it is a little bit frustrating that they're not clicking with his information yet. Verse 18, having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? Don't you remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets of broken pieces did you take up? And they said, 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said, 7. And then he said, don't you still understand? And so we've run out of time, so we're going to come back and reevaluate this frustration moment for Jesus the next time we're into God's Word.